It was no 1984. Nothing is it? But 1905 wasn't so bad. Teddy Roosevelt could hold a beer at least as well as George Orwell, I would think. Times were different, though, that's for sure. Baseball was still the biggest sport in America. Albert Einstein was doing his thing with theoretical physics. The Wright brothers were testing their third airplane. So yeah, different. And even the stuff that's considered dangerous today was a whole lot more dangerous back then. Say, football, for instance. Not to make light of it, but the leatherheads of old weren't just getting hurt playing this new and chaotic sport. They were dying. Well over a dozen people were killed playing football that year alone. The Chicago Tribune famously called it the death harvest.
You had the media at the time calling for the abolition of college football because of the number of deaths.
That's Dennis Denninger, a former ESPN executive who teaches sports communications at Syracuse.
And one newspaper actually referred to these two evils that were plaguing society, lynchings and college football. I mean, that's a number of schools dropped football because of those safety concerns.
This was carnage. Crises facing the sport had built up to where they were existential.
Even a state like Georgia, for example, had a bill on the table to actually abolish playing football in the late 1800s.
Ellen Starosky is a professor at Ithaca College. We've got a strong upstate New York contingent today, who studied the history of the NCAA as closely as anyone.
West Point. And some of the players on that team, there was just a growing number who could actually not serve the military because of the fact that they were getting so beaten up.
And eventually, things got to where the White House stepped in.
This was how serious this issue was in terms of the sheer damage that was occurring to young men. So by the time we get to, you know, around 1904, 1905, that's when Theodore Roosevelt, using the platform of his office in the presidency, that's when he begins to call sport leaders to the White House.
So the president sits them down and says, hey, look, I get it. I'm a rough and tumble guy myself, but you have to do something to get this under control. The dangers of football are such that football itself is now in danger. And if you want to save it, you're going to have to meet me halfway. So the schools got together and laid out a plan for how to change. Sorry, again, Jack Welch. Once they had to. It went by another name first, but today, we call that group the NCAA. This is The Option, Episode 4, The Way Back. A lot happens over the ensuing decades, but the debate over compensation was already there. From the jump, you had all these rules in place that banned paying players. But you also had schools flagrantly ignoring those rules, in no small part because the NCAA started out as a pretty toothless organization.
We've got a report that comes out in 1929 to 1932, where schools that said that they wouldn't be giving out athletic awards, you know, there are like 102 of them that are using all kinds of euphemisms in terms of paying athletes.
Everybody was doing it. And the NCAA just didn't have the juice to stop anyone. And even as it does eventually manage almost 20 years and two world wars later to put new restrictions in place, you still have a number of schools basically giving them the finger. It's not until the 50s that the NCAA flips that power dynamic and starts taking names. The obvious question being, what changed?
That's what brings us to 1951 and the hiring of Walter Byers as the first executive director of the NCAA.
If you're not a big believer in great man history, and I go back and forth on it personally, so that's allowed, then Walter Byers is the sort of figure who might make you reconsider.
His very hiring actually codifies this new era. He's hired to build this infrastructure. He's hired to make it generate revenue. And he's hired to create an enforcement mechanism to keep people in line. And his whole presidency is a testament to the very parameters of what he was hired to do and the vision that he brought to the table along with that.
Ellen will hopefully not mind my saying that even among critics, there is a real awe in terms of what Walter Byers was able to accomplish. he casts a big shadow, and I think it's fair to say that the NCAA would never have become what it has were it not for him. Byers brought to an organization that had never had much of it genuine power, and one of the big early moments in his tenure involved a dramatic exercise of NCAA power that a lot of fans will be familiar with. The infamous death penalty, which makes most people think of SMU football. But decades before they reined in the Mustangs, the NCAA tranquilized the Wildcats. Here's Ben Strauss, a sports and media reporter for the Washington Post and the co-author of 2016's Indentured, the inside story of the rebellion against the NCAA.
There was a point-shaving scandal involving Kentucky in the 1950s, and the first big sort of NCAA penalty, right? He gave the death penalty to Kentucky. They missed a season.
And this was Kentucky, not some up-and-coming program. They were the blue blood, smack in the middle of Coach Adolph Rupp's 41-year run in Lexington. Here I thought Coach Cal had been there a while. When the ban came down in 1952, Kentucky had won the championship 3 out of the prior 6 years. After the Wildcats got a little too wild, the NCAA came down on them, which sounds about right. Of course they did. That's their job, isn't it? But again, the only authority the NCAA could wield back then was the authority they claimed for themselves, the power they got everyone else to believe they had. Very Wizard of Oz, really.
Walter Byers got Kentucky to agree to accept the death penalty, to not play basketball. Right? And in the 1950s, that was not obvious, right? By the 1980s, when the NCAA gives the death penalty to SMU, when the NCAA rules on something, it's sort of carries the force of law, even though it's by no means backed by, you know, any legal doctrine. But in the 50s, it was pretty revolutionary to get buy-in from the SEC, to get buy-in from Kentucky, and say, we're going to hand down this really big penalty of your guys can't play basketball for a year. And that really sort of laid the groundwork for what became the enforcement arm of the NCAA.
The nascent modern NCAA under Byers had proven it had real sway. And just a few years later, Byers showed a knack for creative problem solving, wordsmithing the organization out of a real bind. In 1955, he coined a term you may have heard of, student athlete.
Ray Dennison died playing college football, and literally the headline said, Aggie football player dies of game injuries. Like, it was very clear what happened there.
That's Nicole Auerbach, senior college football writer at The Athletic.
He fractured the top of his skull, shattered the base of his skull against the top of his spine, and he died 30 hours later. And the term originated really from his wife trying to file for death benefits under workers' comp. And the school fought that by saying that he was not entitled to death benefits because he wasn't an employee. Football players were student athletes, not college employees. And that's really where this all began, which it's a really ominous beginning for the term that is used and tossed around so much now.
Today's college athletes are not ignorant to that history. They know it. And it's part of how the NCAA model came to garner more and more scrutiny in the decades that followed. Here's UCLA quarterback and NIL superstar Chase Griffin.
When you look at the creation of that word, it was created to sort of limit our rights, essentially, on these campuses.
No spoilers, but that worked. It continues to work in some respects. And as the NCAA got better at protecting itself, it also got better at administering the rules it used to do so. The enforcement arm of the NCAA became its dominant hand. They came down on all kinds of infractions, ranging from legitimate scandals, like point shaving, for instance, to the pedantic. And after a few decades, just crushing curls with that enforcement arm of theirs, they used it to stop a fast-moving train, the Pony Express.
The SMU football program could be subject to further sanctions, possibly including the NCAA's so-called death penalty.
The sanctions levied against SMU go beyond the one-year death penalty.
The NCAA announcing this morning no football in 87, 7 road games in 88, no scholarships till then, and then only 15.
It's probably the most notorious of all the NCAA's mini crackdowns. That SMU program was demonized, somewhat rightly, but also somewhat not, if only because they were not alone. Bending the rules on the recruiting trail is as old as the trail itself. And what's extra funny about that whole saga is how much of it would technically be allowed now. As time went on, new examples that strained the standards kept on happening. And when people talk about college athletes with a brand, it's hard not to think of the Fab Five at Michigan.
Chris Webber, Jalen Rose, Juwan Howard, Jimmy King, Ray Jackson. The most heralded recruiting class in college basketball history.
Already, baby! Here they go, the Wolverines!
Arrogant in your face? Whoa, you can't jump up in Christian Laettner's face like that.
That's Jalen Rose there at the tail end, of course, providing us our second Christian Laettner stray of the series. Love to see it. That team was massively influential for a number of reasons, and one of them was how vocal they were in pointing to the unfairness of the sports economic model.
They highlighted the hypocrisy because it was about that group and those personalities and the larger-than-life identity that they had.
That's J.A. Adonde, a longtime ESPN personality who now serves as the director of sports journalism at Northwestern.
And it really feels like it was the Fab Five more than it was Michigan basketball. And, you know, it was their jerseys. You think that Chris Webber's number four, for example, that's something that is inescapable when you think of that team. And they were very quick to point out the fact that people were wearing their jerseys, they were buying them in a university bookstore, and they couldn't see any of that money. And they were so outspoken, they were so much in the news.
They were among the first to establish a singular identity above and beyond the school they played for, and they helped usher in the one-and-done era with their success as an all-freshman starting five. But another legacy of that team was the NCAA investigation a decade later, which found a Michigan booster had paid Webber some $280,000 over the course of his high school and college careers. I take it as a given that a lot of stars in the three decades since have at least been offered similar payouts, probably higher. And I'm not about to throw any baseless accusations out there, but let's agree on this. There's way more of this going on than we ever hear about, and that's by design. Guys who have played are rightly careful about what they say on the subject, but the answers you get when you ask are telling all the same. Theo John played college basketball at Marquette and then at Duke in Coach K's final season in Durham.
There's always been money. Different guys, I'll say, were opportunistic on different situations. They were, as the NCAA would love, they were entrepreneur-minded. And they used their college education to make things work. And there's obviously been hush-hush money. I know there's a lot that's already out there. So there's a lot that's, I'm sure, has been covered up very well and tracks covered very well that will never come out.
When we do hear about it, something went wrong. To put it less politely, somebody fucked up or somebody got pissed. And a good bit of both happened at USC in the mid-2000s.
The NCAA cited USC for a lack of institutional control, which detailed numerous violations, primarily involving Heisman Trophy-winning tailback Reggie Bush and men's basketball player O.J. Mayo.
Don't get me wrong, Mayo was a good player. He was a one-and-done guy who went number three in the draft and never quite lived up to the slot. But he's not the main character here. That would be one Reginald Alfred Bush.
Not everybody can do that. I mean, there's about two or three people in the history of football that can make that move.
Reggie Bush, left side, look out. 30, 20, 10, forget it. Reggie Bush, touchdown.
By all accounts, one of the best college football players to ever live. But he did not get to keep that Heisman. He gave it back 5 years later after an NCAA investigation found that Bush had accepted benefits from sports agents who hoped to represent him when he turned pro. It was a whole mess full of salacious news reports and eventually settled lawsuits. But the scandal around Bush's tenure with the Trojans is still playing out to this day, as the Wall Street Journal's Lainey Higgins explains.
After he gave the Heisman back, fast forward another 10 years or so, and the NCAA changes its rules to allow athletes to sign endorsements. Now, endorsements are not necessarily what Reggie Bush did, but he did accept, you know, financial payment, and now athletes can make money. So the day that happened, Reggie released some statement where he was like, huh, this looks a little different than when I played. And he basically re-upped his fight to get his Heisman Trophy back.
Part of the reason Bush is fighting this fight now, almost 20 years later, is because he can argue from a much stronger position than he could back then. The finger pointing is flipped. Bush is suing the NCAA as of a few months ago.
The NCAA has made a statement about me, accusing me of engaging in a pay-for-play arrangement, which is 100% not true. Not only is it not true, but there's no evidence to even support that claim.
Prominent civil rights attorney Ben Crump is helping Bush bring this case, and what he had to say ought to sound familiar by now.
Reggie Bush and college athletes here getting a $1,000 stipend per month. The NCAA and everybody else getting billions of dollars on the backs of these young men and women.
It's that same core grievance, stemming back to the earliest days of the NCAA. Critics have long made the case that the powers that be in college sports were always more concerned with the athlete part than the student part. And a few years after the Bush saga came to a head, a similarly lengthy investigation found that UNC Chapel Hill had played host to the biggest academic fraud scandal in the history of college sports.
More than 3,000 students, nearly half of them athletes, were enrolled in classes that did not exist and got credit just the same.
At least five academic advisors in the athletic department said they used these classes to make sure that athletes who could not compete in the classroom were still able to compete on the field.
Rashad McCants was an all-conference basketball player at UNC, and he talked about his time there in pretty stark terms.
As an athlete, we weren't really there for an education. We were there to, you know, enhance on our athletic abilities. You know, as an athlete, you get a scholarship to the university to play basketball. I clearly didn't go to any classes.
Now, it's not as simple as saying the school orchestrated this from the top. It all started with a rogue office administrator in a single academic department, but a lot of officials up and down the ladder knew of what was going on. That includes athletic staff. McCants said his former head coach, Roy Williams, knew too, an accusation that other former players dispute. We don't know. And the NCAA never came down on UNC, chiefly because, if you were listening closely to my man Scott Pelley earlier, more than half of the students who took those classes weren't athletes. The NCAA couldn't authoritatively prove that this was done for football and basketball players any more than frat bros, who are decidedly not in their jurisdiction. Their hands were tied and their case was closed. But the paper classes scandal contributed to the sense that a lot of outsiders already had about what the system incentivized and prioritized. PBS NewsHour's Gwen Ifill, may she rest in peace, interviewed the attorney who carried out the UNC investigation and asked him a question that is still on people's minds to this day.
UNC is not alone in this. A lot of universities have been implicated in these kinds of questionable activities, and it makes you wonder if the term student athlete is a little bit backward at this point.
It does make you wonder, and it makes you wonder if that's really only starting to change now. Chase Griffin, our quarterback from UCLA, would tell you now's the time.
When I look at this coming age, there's going to be a lot of things that change as far as what the term student athlete means.
This is a guy who personifies the shift as well as anybody out there. In stark contrast to what college sports used to look like, we've got a full-blown economy based solely around the personal brands of college athletes, unheard of and strictly banned for decades.
So I've done probably close to 30 deals now. My first deal was with Degree. Shortly after that, I did a deal with Shell. I've done deals with Discord, LinkedIn, JP Morgan Chase, which I have an ongoing partnership with that I'm very
excited. I see you wearing the hoodie right now. Yeah, that's a company man.
Yeah, exactly.
Griffin was the NIL Male Athlete of the Year in both 2022 and 2023. He got his bachelor's in less than 3 years before then finishing a master's. This guy keeps a busy schedule.
I try to do it in a way where it all works together. You know, football opens up doors for me as far as the NIL, and becoming a market leader in that space opened up doors for me to transition over to general media and entertainment.
And when we zoom out to take stock of where we are, and the very fact that what Chase is doing is even possible, you start to see the potential of this new era married with the way the NCAA has always talked about itself. The GoPro and something other than sports motif earns the mockery it gets for the most part, but there's something to it. There's a reason we encourage kids to play team sports. Those skills do continue translating as you go through life. And athletes like Griffin, who are now able to make more of their personal brands than ever before, think so too.
And I think the cool part about credibility is once you have credibility and build a skill set in one thing, I think it is genuinely transferable. And something that NIL is shining light on is that these athletes who have extremely good time management skills, extreme discipline, the ability to push through mental, emotional, physical, literal pain and still be productive, still be a good teammate, have great teamwork and be positive is invaluable in any workspace.
So this is where we agree that everything's great, right? The kids who are going pro learn some financial literacy before they're handed even larger sums of money, and the kids who aren't going pro get some exposure to the same thing, albeit on a smaller scale. Lessons that start to prepare them for the real world they're about to enter. Great, right? Well, sort of. As ever, what changes for football and basketball tends to be felt very differently in every other sport. Everything we've discussed to this point, whether it's that slippery student-athlete designation or NIL, the transfer portal, conference realignment, shifting revenue structures, everything trickles down in some way or another. So we're going to spend some quality time on the 99 problems of the 99% next time on The Option. The music you heard in this episode comes from Epidemic Sounds. Production and sound editing by Dean Metherill and Joe Engelbrecht. Cover art by Sam Ball. And I'm your host, Michael Hendricks. Catch you next time.